the 71st anniversary of the Japanese Empire air attack on U.S. naval and air installations at Pearl Harbor. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today on RBN, for people who can handle the truth. RBN's website is republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest lineup and relevant links for this program, please visit spingola.com. During the program, email your questions or comments to spingola1 at yahoo.com. My regular email is deanna at spingola.com, but I do not access that email address during the program. You may join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by going to spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. Today we don't have a guest. I'm going to be talking about Japan and the influence that the Anglo-Americans had in that country. And in my second book, I have a chapter called Japan, the Banker's Mercenary in Asia. Now, whatever they did, what they did in Russia, was with the acquiescence of the British and the Americans. Anglo-American imperialistic cooperation and mutual plundering began in 1897, the year of the first official Zionist conference, when Britain and the United States formalized their alliance through the organization of the Pilgrims Society. Especially since 1900, American foreign policy and British foreign policy seem synonymous due to their intimate symbiotic relationship. Britain viewed America differently after Admiral Dewey invaded the Philippines, an opening to the massive riches of the Far East. On September 6, 1899, Britain's Alfred E. Hippisley helped draft the American diplomatic notes. Theodore Roosevelt, who was soon to become president, certainly favored the Anglo-American Accord. He said, and I quote, "Real liberty and real progress are bound up with the prosperity of the English-speaking peoples. I should very strongly favor this country taking a hand if the European continent selected this opportunity to try and smash the British Empire." Unquote. Hayashi Tadusso, the Japanese minister in London, and Henry Petty Fitzmaurice, representing Britain, signed the Anglo-Japanese Treaty on January 30, 1902. On February 8, 1904, Japan launched a surprise attack on the Russian fleet in the harbor of Port Arthur. Over three decades before they would use the same sneak attack tactic against America at Pearl Harbor and in the Philippines in December 1941. However, in 1904, let's hold that thought. We'll pick it up on the other side of the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. And let me just do a brief recap. The British and the Americans decided that in 1897 that they would join forces in the warfare and plundering activities that they would enjoy over the next several decades. In addition to this, Britain, who had already agreed to join America, signed the Anglo-Japanese Treaty on January 30th, 1902. On February 8th, 1904, just over 2 years later, Japan launched a secret surprise attack on the Russian fleet in the harbor of Port Arthur over 3 decades before they would use the same tactic against America at Pearl Harbor and in the Philippines in December 1941. However, in 1904, because of that Anglo-Japanese treaty giving Japan the green light, the American press had no criticisms of this Japanese strategy. The New York Times praised the prompt, enterprising, and gallant feat of the Japanese, and the Lewis Globe Democrat commended the dash and intelligence of the resourceful Sons of Nippon. This attack established Japan as the dominant power in the Far East. They would use this power later on to collect a lot of gold, which ultimately ended up in somebody else's hands. Now, since the end of the Russo-Japanese War, which was 1904 to 1905, Japan's economic presence and political interest in Manchuria had been increasing. The Treaty of Portsmouth had awarded Japan the lease of the South Manchurian Railroad branch of the China Far East Railway. On April 19, 1919, at the Paris Peace Conference, Japanese officials attempted to insert a racial equality clause into the League of Nations covenant, but the Western powers overruled it, which the Japanese viewed as an affront. On February 6, 1922, America and Britain created the Nine Power Treaty, apparently as a method for constraining the Japanese from developing the resources they had acquired from Russia in Manchuria. So it was okay for them to go ahead and attack Russia, but then when they wanted a little bit more power, then that wasn't quite right. So Britain and America created this Nine Power Treaty, and this was a method of constraining the Japanese from developing those resources. Now, Japan saw this as a commercial rivalry against them. China was Japan's principal customer, as China had not developed her own resources and industries. That treaty, which Japan largely ignored, limited Japan's activities in Manchuria and Mongolia, while it allowed unlimited Chinese immigration into the area. And then going ahead quite a few years, on June 6, 1932, President Herbert Hoover appointed Bostonian Joseph C. Grew, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, which, remember, was just developed after the end of World War I. He was a Morgan relative by marriage. He was appointed the U.S. ambassador to Japan. Now, remember that ambassadors usually work with the local authorities and actually just kind of tell them what to do, how to manage their resources, who to let into the country. They have a lot more power. They're not just over there being friendly. They're over there as a handling some of the affairs of the country that they are an ambassador to. Joseph Grew's wife was also the great niece of Commodore Perry. Grew's family were longtime bankers who helped finance the early opium trade into China. Hoover and J.P. Morgan partner Thomas W. Lamont, who also belonged to the Council on Foreign Relations and later would become a member of the Bilderberg Group and was also the Pilgrim Society chairman, was one of Hoover's biggest financial supporters. Hoover mentored Joseph Grew when he was the Undersecretary of State. Agents of the Institute of Pacific Relations, the IPR, a 10-country association concerned with affairs in the Pacific, subtly induced the Japanese to consider militarily targeting the United States. Now, this was as early as 1932. Which was an unimaginable objective given the comparable size, the power and size of each nation. However, remember that Japan did invade Russia, which was an absolutely huge nation. Now, the Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundations financially supported IPR, and the elite Wall Street alliance of Morgan and Rockefeller industrial interests controlled IPR policies. The IPR party line and the Kremlin party line were essentially the same. Morgan and Rockefeller, former competitors, joined forces given their common ambitions long before the official outbreak of World War II. The Rockefellers, who financed the IPR and its activities, simultaneously promoted American warfare against Japan. His competitors, Japan were his competitors for the oil and rubber resources in Southeast Asia, which threatened the Rockefeller dream of capturing the enormous China market for their innumerable petroleum products. Foreign markets for American oil companies were shrinking as crude oil prices declined. China adapted cheaper vegetable oils, causing causing Standard's monopoly in China to dramatically dwindle. The Soviets now controlled a quarter of what remained. Besides, the Japanese had preferential tariff agreements in their colony, Manchuria, and undersold everyone. By 1933, the Soviets were selling gasoline and oil to Siam and Japan, underselling the Anglo-Dutch and the Americans. By August 1933, Japanese businessmen decided to do business with only two foreign companies, Royal Dutch Shell, a Royal Dutch Shell subsidiary, and Saucony Vacuum, and the rest of the business would go to four Japanese firms, including Mitsui Bussan, which received gasoline from Saucony. So this is all about oil. It's all about the markets, worldwide markets, and Standard Oil and their monopoly. Now, the Japanese Ministry of Commerce and Industry sought national control and petroleum self-sufficiency. On September 11, 1933, the ministry introduced comprehensive policies to strengthen control of refining and distribution and encourage greater refining capacity by offering government subsidies to private firms for oil exploration efforts. In 1934, Japanese officials enacted legislation that required licensing for refiners and importers and regulated them, which really vexed Western oil officials. To maintain their influence and profits, Saucony and Shell offered to invest in those refineries, but the Japanese rejected their proposals, which the companies encumbered with stipulations only beneficial to them. Japanese firms, including Matsukata, were faltering and blamed it on the foreign oil companies. They evaluated other oil-rich areas to satisfy their needs. Standard's local manager encouraged U.S. government intervention to force Japan to accept a set quantity of gasoline if they expected a continuation of American crude oil imports. Ambassador Grew directed the State Department to persuade Shell and Standard to cooperate in order to retain the Japanese market. However, the American oil overproduction and enormous quantities of Russian oil threatened continued high profits. On April 2, 1934, Walter C. Teagle, president of the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, met with Interior Secretary and Oil Administrator Harold Ickes to enlist his help in enacting legislation to regulate crude oil production without affecting refinery productivity and marketing. Teagle also wanted the government to make the East Texas oil field a reserve. To further restrict domestic oil production, he wanted the government to issue interest-bearing bonds to smaller independent companies in exchange for their property. Pretty tricky. Standard, adept at controlling American policies, intended to use government power to maneuver the international market in the same way. Purging independent oil producers would limit oil exports to Japan and elsewhere and give exclusivity to Standard, Shell, and Texaco. Japan and China erroneously assumed that they could extract oil and control oil within their own countries or protectorates. How strange that they would think that. Beginning on February 1, 1934, the Chinese government levied an import tax on kerosene and gasoline to facilitate the future development of a national oil and gas industry in order to decrease dependence on foreign resources. America and British oil companies refused to do business under those conditions. Chinese officials relented finally, but launched the four-year plan, a goal for domestic oil production in the Shanxi and Sichuan provinces with a potential yield of 80 million gallons per year from 500 wells. Be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and we don't have a guest today. I'm talking about Japan and some of their history and what led up to 1941. Officials in Nanking arranged to work, and this is China, arranged to work with the Benedum Tree Company of Pittsburgh, a private oil exploration company. The U.S. Minister to China, Nelson T. Johnson, and the State Department disqualified the Benedum contract, claiming that the contract violated the United States policies against monopolies. They must not have heard about Standard, or that Standard had some exclusive connections to the State Department. The State Department then and now only protects selected American businesses while quashing others. Johnson witnessed similar oil nationalization moves in China and suggested that American oil companies hurry and negotiate with the Manchukuo monopoly for the sale of their crude oil and then liquidate their distribution apparatus in Manchukuo. Tokyo-based Ambassador Gru, friendly to Standard Oil, admitted futility in trying to influence the Japanese to abandon their self-sufficiency efforts and sent a dispatch to Washington suggesting an oil embargo against Japan. Teagle and Shell's leadership conferred with Ike's and State Department officials on August 22nd and 23rd, 1934. Oil companies refused to comply with Japan's new regulations because it would decrease their profits. They demanded an oil embargo and more representation to the Japanese government. Ike's could, if persuaded, authorize an embargo order against Japan. So more representation to the Japanese government meant more ambassadors to go over there and intimidate them and threaten them. Earl R. Dickover of the U.S. Embassy in Japan told Kurusu Saburo that, and he's a Japanese guy, that the U.S. government would impose an oil embargo if warranted, especially if Standard lost the Manchurian kerosene market. Kurusu emphasized that American oil companies accepted the loss of their vested interest in France and other countries with similar national oil objectives. The American oil companies asked Ambassador Gru to intervene in their behalf. Otherwise, as stated in Business Week, New York and London would force Japan into a showdown. Oil officials whined to Secretary Ike's, complaining about their financial losses. Henry Detering claimed that the British and the Dutch governments would support American actions. Teagle wanted an oil embargo and a restriction of oil exports to Japan by all producers. If independence balked, he was certain that the State Department could sway them. Detering went to Europe to sell the blockade proposal to the British and Dutch governments. Standard, Shell, and Texaco mutually agreed to cut off all oil to Japan. Now, keep in mind that Japan had no oil of her own. She did want to develop the resources that were in Manchuria and was doing that, but then the U.S. government did not allow the one company out of Pennsylvania to help them do that. Standard Oil of California and Union Oil of California were unwilling and instead gave a price quote to Japan. The independents received immediate pressure, capitulated, and withdrew their bids. In September 1934, Teagle, back in Washington, complained about the Associated Oil Group in California, which owned 50% of a Japanese refinery and had a long-term contract to supply that refinery with crude oil. Teagle wanted Ickes and the Interior Department's agencies to devise policies to alter the Associated Oil Group's arrangement. Standard and Shell officials maintained correspondence with the Japanese government officials. State Department officials wanted Standard to work with the British and Dutch oil producers and consider complying with the Japanese regulations. Teagle would not budge. Now remember, Teagle's with Standard. Surely, the U.S. government could dictate terms to Japan. After all, Japan had no significant alternatives and inadequate natural resources to be self-sufficient. American oil firms could cut Japan from other markets and restrict her access to oil-bearing lands. By mid-autumn 1934, Japan's oil situation was critical. On November 27, 1934, State Department representatives met with London's Foreign Office to consider their options. Teagle and Detterding were unconcerned about Venezuela, Russia, or Mexico obstructing the embargo. However, Ickes might get pressure from some American oil companies. They decided to embargo both Japan and Manchuria. In confidential talks, desperate Japanese gas company representatives agreed to almost every demand after negotiations ended on April 13, 1935. However, we have to go to a break. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and I was talking about the confidential talks of Japanese gas oil representatives. Now, keep in mind that Manchuria, that Japan won part of Manchuria in their war with Russia, and it was the part that Russia had some claim to. They had gone in there, put a lot of money into the area, sunk a lot of investments. There were some Russians living in the area. They were developing the oil and the other resources there. And when Japan won the war, it was a one-year war, and the main reason they won the war is because they were getting funded by the Jewish bankers, and the Jewish bankers said they would help Russia, but they just didn't deliver any of the ammunition that Russia needed. And so Japan, being a very small country but having a lot of ammunition and money behind them, won the war. It ended, as I said, in 1 year or less. And then they took over that part of Manchuria, and they renamed it Manchukuo. And so I was mentioning that in confidential talks, desperate Japanese gas company representatives agreed to almost every demand after the negotiations ended on April 13, 1935. However, that did not persuade the those officials to rescind the Japanese law. On April 18, 1935, a Standard vacuum official, Kuruzi F. Co., asked the State Department to notify the company's Tokyo agent to reiterate that inasmuch as it was contractually impossible to stop sales of crude oil from California, Standard Vacuum intended to add an extra premium of 25 cents on Manchukuo exports. Co. warned of other obstacles and extra supply costs. In addition, Standard Oil or Texaco refused to ship any more oil to the Manchuria Oil Company. So the American industrial giants were going to get their way no matter what Japan did, no matter what laws they had. On May 18, 1935, Standard Oil billed the Manchu Kuo government for damages and loss of business, a total of $1,781,880.59, including property and equipment. Then, and of course, it's a bogus bill. Then in late September, the Japanese government stated that they had deferred the decision about reserve supplies until June 30, 1936. The oil companies objected, as other countries might follow suit. The oil companies finally accepted the storage regulations, but asked Mitsui to capitalize the storage facilities. The storage issue remained a problem throughout the summer of 1936. Meanwhile, the Japanese government obtained a petroleum concession in Mexico. However, East Asian prospects worsened. Ambassador Gru warned the State Department that the Japanese insisted on self-sufficiency. They passed additional laws, such as the Synthetic Petroleum Production Law, the Imperial Fuel Development Company Law, and the Petroleum Resources Exploitation Law. The American oil companies experienced discrimination in Korea and Japanese-controlled China with no hopes of recovering their investments. Influential Anglo-American oil companies preferred profits over peace. They waged economic warfare against Japan throughout the 1930s. Their egregious actions against Japan, China, Thailand, and other countries throughout Asia revealed their priorities, all backed by the State Department. Ambassador Gru wrote, and I quote, "The application of economic pressure against Japan would inevitably start our relations on a downward course unless or until we are prepared to face eventual war," unquote. Gru, understanding the oil interest, wrote, and I quote, "Economic pressures in the form of embargoes and other similar steps are a form of warfare, and they definitely constitute threats," unquote. Now, we know that that America and Britain have always used embargoes. They did it, Britain did it early during the 1812-1814 wars. On August 14th, 1936, at Chautauqua, New York, President Franklin D. Roosevelt said, and I quote, "We shun political commitments which might entangle us in foreign wars." What a joke. "We avoid connection with political activities of the League of Nations. We are not isolationists except insofar as we seek to isolate ourselves completely from war. I have seen war. I hate war. I have passed unnumbered hours. I shall pass unnumbered hours thinking and planning how war can be kept from this nation. I wish I could keep war from all nations, but that is beyond my power. I can at least make certain that no act of the United States helps to produce or promote war," unquote. That is so laughable, I cannot believe it. And this was in 1936 when he and Churchill were developing bombs in order to go to war against Germany. In 1937, Roosevelt planned to blockade Japan, but American citizens responded negatively to his quarantine speech of October 5th in the same year. So he temporarily scrapped his plan. In 1938, his war planners created a new preliminary plot for a naval war against Japan. Both Germany and the Soviet Union invaded Poland in September 1939. Britain and France ignored the Soviet invasion, but quickly declared war on Germany. American politicians, especially Franklin D. Roosevelt, intended on getting the country embroiled in warfare against Germany, despite what American citizens wanted. He promised neutrality if reelected, but insiders knew better. If an opportunity did not present itself, he would manufacture one. In August 1940, to prepare for war, Roosevelt assigned the National Guard to federal service for 1 year. He sent a peacetime draft, known as the Burke-Wadsworth Act, to Congress. And then Congress passed the Selective Training and Service Act of 1940 on September 14, 1940. Roosevelt traded 50 old American Navy destroyers to England in exchange for leases in Bermuda, the Bahamas, Jamaica, St. Lucia, Trinidad, and British Guiana. He signed legislation worth $5 billion to create a two-ocean navy that would ultimately incorporate 100 aircraft carriers. And this is in 1940, people. On September 27, 1940, Japan, Germany, and Italy, comprising the Axis powers, signed the Tripartite Treaty in Berlin, a military alliance which stipulated that if the Allied nations, which comprised Britain, the United States, and the Soviet Union, attacked any one of the three Axis nations, then all three of those nations would automatically be at war. The feasibility of Germany attacking America was zero due to Germany's lack of big planes. Germany was fortunate to be able to reach Britain with their lightweight planes. However, if America responded to a Japanese attack, then, according to the treaty, the United States would enter into the European War. On October 7, 1940, Lieutenant Commander Arthur H. McCollum, the head of the Far East Desk for U.S. Navy Intelligence, devised an eight-step plan entitled Estimate of the Situation in the Pacific and Recommendations for Action by the United States to Provoke Japan to Attack the U.S., supposedly to avert Japan's hegemony over East Asia. Number one, arrange with Britain to use British bases in the Pacific, particularly Singapore. Number two, arrange with Holland to use base facilities and acquisition of supplies in the Dutch East Indies. Number three, give all possible aid to the Chinese government of Chiang Kai-shek. Number four, send a division of long-range heavy cruisers to the Orient, Philippines, or Singapore. Number five, send two divisions of submarines to the Orient. Number six, keep the main strength of the American fleet now in the Pacific in the vicinity of the Hawaiian Islands. Number seven, insist that the Dutch refuse to grant Japanese demands for undue economic concessions, particularly oil. Number eight, completely embargo all American trade with Japan in collaboration with a similar embargo imposed by Britain. McCollum wrote, and I quote, if by these means Japan could be led to commit an overt act of war, so much the better. At all events, we must be fully prepared to accept the threat of war, unquote. Is this awful or what? This document remained classified until 1994. Roosevelt immediately implemented McCollum's eight-step program. Accordingly, in October 1940, Roosevelt requested Navy Secretary Frank Knox to order Admiral James O. Richardson, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet in the Pacific, to position American naval ships across the Pacific Ocean in order to prevent Japan from obtaining crucial supplies. Okay, this was part of the blockade. Richardson protested that this blockade was an obvious act of war. His fleet, inadequately prepared for war, had previously patrolled the West Coast. He requested that his fleet be withdrawn from Hawaii, where they were totally exposed and vulnerable. Washington ignored his request. In January 1941, Admiral Kimmel replaced Richardson, and he quickly raised the same issues with President Roosevelt. On December 16, 1941, after Pearl Harbor, officials demoted Admiral Kimmel and relieved him of his command. Okay. We'll backtrack just a bit here. On January 27th, 1941, and this was after the blockade and after all the things that they had done, after imposing the eight-step program, Ambassador Joseph Grew sent a telegram to Secretary of State Cordell Hull reporting the following, and I quote, the Peruvian minister has informed a member of my staff that he heard from many sources, including a Japanese source, that in the event of trouble breaking out between the United States and Japan, the Japanese intend to make a surprise attack against Pearl Harbor, unquote. Hull was the architect, and just a side note, Hull was the architect of the federal income tax laws of 1913-1916 and was instrumental in establishing the United Nations. People refer to him as the father of the UN. He promoted regulated free trade, which people devised in order to stifle free enterprise and destroy national borders. Free trade is just another term for globalism and nationalization and internationalization. By January through March 1941, during the joint staff conferences in Washington, along with the Singapore Agreement of April 21st through the 27th, 1941, with the British, Roosevelt had persuaded American officials to wage a naval war against Japan if she so much as even crossed a particular point in the Pacific without a threat or an attack to any American ship or area. Roosevelt, backed by a highly biased and communist-stacked State Department, deployed the Pacific Fleet from San Diego to Pearl Harbor, contrary to the counsel of the admirals Harold R. Stark and James O. Richardson, who, beginning in January 1940, was the commander-in-chief United States American Pacific Fleet and the Navy's authority on Pacific naval warfare and Japanese strategy. When told to deploy the fleet to Pearl Harbor, certainly a potential target of a Japanese attack, he refused to comply. However, as I mentioned before, Roosevelt overruled him, and he either resigned or the government relieved him of his command in February 1941. On July 26, 1941, Roosevelt froze all Japanese assets in the United States and closed the Panama Canal to all of that nation's shipping. Between November 27th and December 6, 1941, the State, War, and Navy departments received several warnings about Japanese intentions, including specific details like the exact hour and the date of the attack. American military commanders in the Philippines, General Douglas MacArthur, and Admiral Thomas Hart were part of the network that received decoded messages. American codebreakers had broken Japan's code using a device called magic. Operators could read messages sent to Japanese diplomats worldwide. The United States sent decoding machines to London, Singapore, and the Philippines, but not to Pearl Harbor. Unfortunately, General Short and Admiral Kimmel in Hawaii were not part of the network. Admiral Kimmel told Colonel Curtis B. Dahl, and I quote, "I found out later that the Japanese task force approaching Pearl Harbor had specific orders that if the American forces at Pearl Harbor became alerted before the attack was launched, their task force was to return at once to Japanese waters without attacking." So, can you imagine that? If the Americans knew, and if the Japanese found out, then the Japanese wouldn't have attacked. Okay, Henry L. Stimson, who belonged to Skull and Bones, was a Standard Oil attorney and an influential member of the ruling elite for decades. He was Secretary of State from 1911 to 1913 under William Howard Taft, who was also Skull and Bones, and President Herbert Hoover from 1929 to 1933, and was Roosevelt's War Secretary from 1940 to 1945. After meeting with Roosevelt on October 16, 1941, Stimson wrote in his diary, and I quote, "We face the delicate question of the diplomatic fencing to be done so as to be sure Japan is put into the wrong and makes the first bad move, over move," unquote. On November 15, 1941, General George C. Marshall, Army Chief of Staff, swore a group of reporters to secrecy and told them that if war erupted with Japan, and I quote, "we'll fight mercilessly. Flying fortresses will be dispatched immediately to set the paper cities of Japan on fire. There won't be any hesitation about bombing civilians. It will be all out," unquote. He later received the Nobel Peace Prize for his European Recovery Program, the Marshall Plan, which redistributed U.S. wealth to well-connected corporations to rebuild Japan, to rebuild Europe after the British and the U.S. bombs had destroyed it. Okay, we're going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Alrighty, I am back. This is Deanna. We're talking about the Japanese situation in 1941. On November 25th, 1941, after another meeting with Roosevelt, Stimson recorded in his diary, and I quote, "The question was how we should maneuver them, the Japanese, into the position of firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves. It was a difficult proposition," unquote. On November 25th, 1941, that same day, Roosevelt met with Secretary of State Cordell Hull, War Secretary Stimson, Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox, General Marshall, and Admiral Stark. The purpose of the meeting was to discuss how to provoke Japan to take the first shot. Without the approval or knowledge of Congress, and most certainly against every constitutional principle, they devised the war ultimatum, a list of 10 demands made to the government of Japan. The next day, Secretary Hull delivered Roosevelt's ultimatum to the Japanese ambassador, whose name I can't pronounce, at the State Department. Hull knew that the Japanese would never accept the ultimatum. Historian Charles Tansel wrote, and I quote, "The Japanese attack upon Pearl Harbor fulfilled the fondest hopes of the Roosevelt cabinet. It was easy now to denounce Japanese perfidy and to exult in the fact that the shock of the tragedy had erased all divisions of opinion in America," unquote. Japan, a group of islands, depended on the mainland for raw materials and food, so it was imperative that China remain free from communist takeover. The Japanese could not accept demand number 3 of Roosevelt's ultimatum, which said the government of Japan will withdraw all military, naval, air, and police forces from China and from Indochina. This withdrawal would have enabled a communist conquest of the mainland, and the communists would have subsequently starved the Japanese into submission. Consequently, this forced the Japanese to either attack or surrender. The other 9 demands were conditional upon Japanese compliance of demand number 3. Roosevelt, arrogant and pro-communist, had no business making any demands, but rather should have encouraged Japan in her efforts to rescue China from communism. However, Roosevelt's pro-communist foreign policy compelled Japan to launch a defensive war against the U.S. so that Roosevelt could justify entering the war against Germany, Japan's ally. On December 4, 1941, the government informed the public about the strategies developed by the Air War Plans Division through U.S. newspapers. They created AWPD, which is Air War Plans, with European military industrial targets in mind. However, certain air war conspirators were already promoting incendiary attacks against Japan. Roosevelt, an honorary Pilgrim Society member, and Winston Churchill, also a Pilgrims member, and the Rothschild Minion, had already made commitments to fight against Germany before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, keep in mind that the Pilgrim Society is a very important society. You will not hear too much about it. Every single solitary president since the first Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, has been a member of the Pilgrim Society up to and including the president right now and the Secretary of State. All presidents and Secretary of States. Okay, we'll be right back after station ID. All righty, welcome back. This is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. This is Deanna Spingola, and we're talking about Japan. And thanks to Bob in D.C., he mentioned a movie and then told me how to pronounce Manchu Kuo. Okay, Manchu Kuo. I don't know how I was saying, but I know it was wrong. People who read a lot and don't listen much or attend movies that you know, give you the pronunciations, well, what can I say? Robert B. Stinnett spent 17 years researching Japan's Pearl Harbor attack, all substantiated by official documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. He wrote that there were, in 1941, 22 Pacific Rim radio intercept stations, including four cryptographic centers, especially set up to decode Japanese diplomatic and military communications. The Netherlands government was in exile in London right after the beginning of the war. The communications network extended from America's west coast to China's east coast and from Dutch Harbor, Alaska, to Batavia, located on the island of Java in the Dutch East Indies. The United States supervised at least 15 of these monitoring stations. Prior to Pearl Harbor, Tokyo sent daily bomb plots cabled from its Honolulu consulate to the attack fleet using JN-25 radio messages, a very old code. Roosevelt also received these messages, yet the U.S. government still refuses to release any of those JN-25 messages because it would reveal that both Roosevelt and Churchill monitored the Japanese attack fleet all the way to Pearl Harbor. According to testimony at the International Military Tribunal for the Far East, Hirohito, dressed in full military uniform, also monitored all radio transmissions from Admiral Yamamoto's flagship during the night of December 7th to the 8th, 1941. After the war, Japanese officials portrayed Hirohito as a peace lover who they kept completely ignorant of all warfare decisions and activities. Feigning ignorance or incompetence are oft used political ploys. Britain and the United States declared war on Japan on December 8, 1941, 24 hours after Japan's Pearl Harbor attack. Predictably, Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor sank or severely damaged 19 ships belonging to the U.S. Pacific Fleet. Additionally, the Japanese either destroyed or critically disabled 340 naval and army aircraft. Roosevelt had sent all of the newer ships to the Atlantic, probably in preparation for warfare with Germany, Japan's ally. The remaining ships in Pearl Harbor were from World War I. In his testimony before Congress, Admiral Claude C. Block said, and I quote, "The Japanese only destroyed a lot of old hardware. In a sense, they did us a favor," unquote. Our war declaration against Japan was an automatic war declaration against Germany, the ultimate goal of Pearl Harbor. In order to immediately assign guilt to the Japanese and dispel any suspicion from his administration, Roosevelt initiated an investigation. On December 18, 1941, he issued an executive order creating a commission to investigate any U.S. Army and Navy personnel who might be guilty of dereliction of duty. Can you believe this? Yet, I guess it is believable. We've seen it. We saw it before that. We've seen it since. Yet the commission was restricted and could not consider elected officials who supervised the military, you know, like the president and Stimson and all those people. Stimson actually chose three of the five commission members. Stacked commissions typically exonerate the guilty and blame others who are either dead or completely maligned. The public. Oh, okay, we have a break. We'll be right back. 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Stacked commissions, meaning government commissions that they stack whomever is going to be on the commission. Stacked commissions typically exonerate the guilty and blame others who are either dead or completely maligned. The public, either naive or ignorant, accept commission findings or government versions of any catastrophic event as if the investigation was objective and concise, despite glaring evidence to the contrary. The commission, by design, never considered Roosevelt and his duplicitous, murderous cronies. Stimson chose Owen Josephus Roberts, an associate U.S. Supreme Court justice, to head the commission. Roberts, an interventionist and an internationalist who, like many others, believes that the United States should lead the world in creating an international court. He gave a renowned speech, The National Security Constitution in an Age of Globalization. A world court would adjudicate a profusion of humanitarian abuses while building credibility for global governance. Because of the impending election, Roosevelt hoped to avoid a congressional inquiry by appointing his own investigation headed by Roberts. Due to those ever-present alleged national security issues, a commission was unable to examine any relevant records regarding Japan's radio intercepts. The Navy's intercept operators were not allowed to testify or produce their radio logs, documents, or anything that revealed the facts. Roosevelt made certain that the commission did not have any information that exposed the administration's part in the operation. The commission was informed about some of the Japanese intercepted messages before Pearl Harbor, but they were not told the contents. The commission blamed General Short and Admiral Kimmel, the commanders in Hawaii, and accused them of dereliction of duty. They accused them of failing to follow defensive procedures and policies. Further, the commission reported that Admiral Stack and General Marshall acted honorably. Roosevelt reviewed the misleading report prior to its public release. Those who understand the actual circumstances rejected the commission's findings. Admiral James Richardson, Kimmel's predecessor, said, and I quote, "It is the most unfair, unjust, and deceptively dishonest document ever printed by the government printing office. I cannot conceive of honorable men serving on the commission without greatest regret and deepest feelings of shame," unquote. The public generally accepted the commission's conclusions. Congressional leaders praised the report, actually giving it undeserved credibility. Yet, like other government commissions, it was a complete whitewash. Government investigations are akin to the mafia investigating criminal activities. General Short had been friends with General Marshall for 40 years. Admiral Kimmel considered his boss, Admiral Stark, as a friend since their Naval Academy days. However, after the successful Pearl Harbor operation, some people received rewards and promotions while the government ruined the careers of others. Marshall chaired the Joint Chiefs of Staff while the government maligned and fired Kimmel and Short. On December 11, 1941, Rear Admiral Lee Noyce, the Navy's Director of Communications, imposed a 54-year censorship policy on the pre-attack Japanese military and diplomatic intercepts and any other relevant directives. All records were consigned to Navy vaults. Noyce denied issuing such an order, but later admitted that he may have even ordered the destruction of the records, which occurred just a few days before the President's Board of Inquiry. In August 1945, officials classified all extant documents as top secret, even to members of Congress. The war conspirators got us into the war. They included Standard Oil attorney Henry L. Stimson, an ally of J.P. Morgan banker Thomas W. Lamont, and a law partner with Elihu Root in a firm on Wall Street, the powerful nucleus of the American establishment. War Secretary Stimson, under Roosevelt and Truman, drafted and trained 12 million soldiers and airmen and directed the purchase through well-connected firms of 30% of the nation's industrial output to the battlefield. He was responsible for the internment and subsequent property seizure of thousands of Japanese-American citizens. Stimson contrived the economic provocations targeted at Japan to manipulate them into firing the first shot, facilitated by Japan-based Ambassador Joseph Grew and many well-placed members of the Institute of Pacific Relations who urged Japan's willing war hawk leaders to respond. Stimson supervised General Leslie R. Groves, head of the Manhattan Project, developers of the atomic bomb. Hollister Bundy, who was Skull and Bones, was Stimson's special assistant at the Pentagon for the Manhattan Project. His two sons, William and McGeorge Bundy, both skull and bones, followed in their father's global government footprints. Later, Stimson, a significant influence on President Harry S. Truman, personally chose Hiroshima and Nagasaki as the targets for the atom bombs, a message to the world at the beginning of the Cold War, and an excuse for the massive military buildup to shrink the U.S. Treasury while benefiting corporations associated with the military. In October 1944, a Navy and Army court deliberated possible foreknowledge and culpability surrounding Pearl Harbor. Between November 27th and December 6, 1941, officials in the state, war, and Navy departments received numerous pieces of information giving specific information about the imminent Japanese attack. In fact, if you go to my schedule page, you will see a newspaper, the two newspapers that were printed in Hawaii, talking about an attack over the, a possible attack over the weekend. So just click on that link on today's date. The courts found Washington officials guilty of not acting on information that caused the avoidable slaughter of over 2,400 individuals. When they revealed the verdict, General George C. Marshall, guilty as charged. Now, this is another kind of a court. This isn't the official commission, but this is another court that they had. General George C. Marshall, guilty as charged, offered his resignation, which, of course, his superiors rejected. Other issues overshadowed the verdict, and the public heard nothing about it. Marshall asserted under oath that he considered loyalty to his chief more imperative than loyalty to his country. Later, using the excuse of ill health, Marshall refused to appear before the Joint Congressional Committee that investigated the tragedy of Pearl Harbor. Do you suppose he ever took responsibility? Not in his lifetime. Congress ordered Stimson to open another investigation on Pearl Harbor. In 1944, he chose Christian Clausen, a 33rd degree Freemason, an attorney and a former assistant U.S. attorney from San Francisco, to conduct a thorough, objective investigation. He interviewed dozens of people and submitted his report on September 14, 1945. He ultimately wrote a book about the investigation just before his death. When Clausen called on Harry Truman, he found him somewhat uncooperative and even unfriendly, until Clausen told him, and I quote, "When you were the Grand Master of the Masons in Missouri, I was Grand Orator of the Masonic Grand Lodge of California," unquote. Truman immediately bounded from his chair and began enthusiastically shaking Clausen's hand. Truman said, and I quote, "You'll have my complete cooperation, Henry," unquote. Roosevelt said to the U.S. Congress a month after Pearl Harbor, and I quote, "There never has been, there never can be, successful compromise between good and evil. Only total victory can reward the champions of tolerance and decency and faith," unquote. In April 1995, the Kimmel and Short families asked Congress to conduct an investigation as they wanted to clear the reputations of the two men who the original commission had accused of negligence and therefore were responsible for 2,400 and two American deaths and 1,282 wounded at Pearl Harbor. Congress conceded and conducted a one-day show hearing and opted to accept the earlier findings. Congress arbitrarily decided that Marshall, Roosevelt, and other officials did not withhold critical information from Admiral Kimmel or General Short. The Pentagon also conducted an investigation for 7 months under the direction of Edwin Dorn, the Undersecretary of Defense, who issued a 50-page report on December 1, 1995, rejecting the petitions of the Kimmel and Short families. Dorn agreed with the earlier conclusions. Is this just the most amazing thing? Isn't that something that, over almost 2,500 deaths, all this destruction, all planned and plotted by Churchill and by Roosevelt, both of which belonged to the Pilgrim Society, both of which were in full agreement of that earlier alliance that that the two countries agreed to back in 1897, the year of the first Zionist conference. We'll be back after a word from our sponsors. All right, welcome back. This is Deanna, and we're talking about, we're talking about Pearl Harbor, but oftentimes we only hear what happened at Pearl Harbor. We don't hear about what happened in the Philippines. And this is really bad. What happened in the Philippines the day after? But let's start. Let me give you a little history. On November 27, 1941, the American military secretly began to construct the Del Monte Field in a meadow on the pineapple plantation, which was capable of accommodating heavy bombers. They completed it on December 5th with two runways, number one, which was the main runway, and number two, which was the pursuit runway. On December 6th, officials sent two squadrons of B-17s from Clark Field, which would be 16 of its 35 bombers, on Luzon down to Del Monte No. 1. However, there were no maintenance facilities or any equipment to support them there. On December 14, 1941, in response to the Japanese invasion, the American Army Air Forces sent three B-17s from the Del Monte Field to attack the landing force. They managed to hit a Japanese minesweeper and possibly a destroyer. They also hit nine naval aircraft based on the Legazpi Strip. The unescorted B-17s made a hasty retreat, but only one of them made it back to Del Monte. The Japanese only lost four fighters. Given the circumstances, it was apparent that the heavy bombers were incapable of operating effectively in the Philippines. Therefore, on December 15th, General Louis H. Brereton requested authority to move the B-17s to a base in Australia, 1,500 miles away, where the planes would be safe and receive proper servicing. He intended to operate from there, making Del Monte an advance base from which to strike the Japanese in the Philippines. The first groups of B-17s left Del Monte that very day. Now, the Japanese land invasion of the Philippines occurred on December 22, 1941, and this was just 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor. And it's interesting. If we have time, I'll talk to you about what happened on December 8th in the Philippines, because the Japanese didn't just attack at Pearl Harbor. They also attacked in the Philippines. But anyway, the Japanese land invasion occurred on December 22, 1941, just 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor. General Douglas MacArthur was to use five delaying positions in central Luzon, according to the United States pre-war plan Orange, which he implemented on December 24, 1941. He sent General George Parker of the South Luzon Force, the commander of the second troops, which covered the eastern half of the peninsula, to Bataan to prepare defensive positions. Military forces under Major General Jonathan Wainwright would remain and resist the enemy on the beach and then depart for Bataan to wait reinforcements. This would allow those from military headquarters and various officials from the Philippine government to safely withdraw to Bataan. MacArthur's defense strategy, entitled Plan Orange, originally conceived by Rear Admiral Raymond P. Rogers, was in 1911. So they were right up to date, right, folks? The Joint Army and Navy Board formally adopted it in 1924. Although it was decades old, the military had thoroughly reviewed it and made no changes. On Christmas Eve, 1941, General MacArthur, his staff, President Manuel Quezon, his wife and three children, and leading government officials escaped from Manila to the Malinta Tunnel on the fortified island of Corregidor, which became the seat of Philippines government. Corregidor was an island in the entrance of Manila Bay, the best natural harbor in the Far East, and the site of the Del Monte Pineapple Plantation and the new airfield in Mindanao. Those departing government officials included Vice President Osmeña, Manuel Rocas, Chief Justice Jose Santos, Major General Basilio Valdez, Secretary of National Defense, Colonel Andre Soriano, Secretary of Finance, and Colonel Manuel Nieto. Quezon's departure caused apprehension and a feeling of hopelessness and despair. I mean, the president of the Philippines was leaving. On December 30th, 1941, President Quezon and Vice President Osmeño took their oaths of office from Chief Justice Santos, as they had been elected for a second term in November. Now, this is where it gets interesting. The gold reserves from the Treasury and the gold bullion from the Benque mines was transferred to the Malinta Tunnel, Corregidor's large, secure complex. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, through the Voice of Freedom broadcast, a message to the Filipino people on December 28, 1941, pledging his solemn support and promising, and I quote, "Their freedom will be redeemed," unquote. Obviously, the U.S. government considered it a lost battle. On January 2, 1942, the Japanese entered Manila. Major General Wainwright's men, with their old and defective World War I Enfield rifles, were unable to prevent Japan's invading General Homa Masaharu from advancing to Manila. Apparently, they had no choice but to flee. This is deliberate defeat, people. All right, we're going to a break. We'll be right back. Alrighty, welcome back. This is Deanna. Now, I mentioned General MacArthur. That's Douglas MacArthur. He officially retired in December 1937, but he stayed on active duty. And on July 26, 1941, President Roosevelt recalled him to active duty in the U.S. Army and assigned him as the commander of the U.S. Army forces in the Far East, promoting him to a lieutenant general. And the entire Philippine Army, including Ferdinand Marcos, was inducted into the U.S. Army. And MacArthur was recalled, as I said, on July 26, 1941, the same day that Roosevelt froze all of the Japanese assets in the U.S. and closed the Panama Canal. General MacArthur, in September, he began organizing the Philippine Department Air Force, Department Air Force, and they kind of expected that maybe that Japan would attack the Philippines in the spring of 1942. And so MacArthur was in charge of getting the Philippine Army ready. And, you know, I don't know what else he was in charge of over there. But we do know that the State, War, and Navy departments received several warnings about the Japanese intentions regarding Pearl Harbor. And remember also that the U.S. sent decoder machines to the Philippines, to General MacArthur and Admiral Thomas Hart. However, they did not send, you know, those warning devices to Pearl Harbor. Now, the Philippines is that he basically allowed MacArthur ordered, as I mentioned, the construction engineers to enlarge the field, the Del Monte pineapple plantation, and MacArthur's headquarters received word of the Pearl Harbor attack at 2:30 a.m. on December 8, 1941, and should have been prepared and vigilant. MacArthur radar tracked the progress of the Japanese planes as they approached the Philippines. He acknowledged them at 140, 100, 80, 60, all the way down to 20 miles away. Does this remind you of anything? All the way down to 20 miles away from their target. Then he gave an order to respond. When Japan's bombers appeared over Luzon, MacArthur's fighters were purportedly unable to find the enemy's planes. Hart, that's Admiral Hart, had almost two dozen submarines that could have provided defense, but he kept them in the port and did not interfere with the enemy assault. Soon after the attack on Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt relieved both Hawaiian commanders, remember General Walter Short and Admiral Husband E. Kimmel, from their assignments. The Japanese attacked 8 of the 10 warships that Hart sent south. And in 1945, Hart returned to the U.S. and was appointed to the Senate. And the attack on the Philippines occurred 10 hours after the Pearl Harbor attack on December 8th at 12:35 p.m. when 196 Japanese Navy bombers struck the U.S. air bases at Clark and Iba Fields. This assault effectively crippled the Far East Air Force of the U.S. Army Air Force, consisting of 35 long-range Boeing 4-engine B-17 bombers and 91 Warhawk fighters. It was the largest force outside of the U.S. Clark Field. It was the largest force outside of the U.S. Clark Field also lost the use of its radar units, those that MacArthur had used and apparently ignored. The Japanese attack against the Philippines by air, land, and sea forced the U.S. and Filipino troops into a total retreat on the Bataan Peninsula and later to the fortress of Corregidor within 2 weeks following the attack. And now I'm going to... Clark Field, the U.S. air base, was utterly destroyed in 4 days, along with 75% of the planes. Americans who survived the Japanese assault against Clark Field were amazed at the precision bombing and destruction by the Mitsubishi-built Zero, apparently a remarkably superior fighting plane. The U.S. lost 2 bases in the Philippines because Japan immediately occupied the islands when MacArthur failed to respond to the impending attack following Pearl Harbor. This failure allowed Japan to continue savaging and plundering gold and other valuables throughout Asia without any U.S. military obstructions. That's a very important thing to remember, folks. On December 8, 1941, Japanese forces also attacked Hong Kong, the British Crown Colony, and the Dutch East Indies. Then they used the acquired bases in French Indochina to invade Thailand and launch an assault against Malaya. MacArthur's reaction to his entire Air Force being destroyed was an anomaly, to say the least. He sequestered himself in his room and refused to talk to anyone, including Major General Louis Brereton, the air commander. MacArthur had refused to attack air bases on Formosa despite orders from the War Department. Instead, he gave conflicting orders that guaranteed that the planes remained on the ground all morning so that they would be damaged. The destruction of the bombers in the Philippines comprised half of all U.S. heavy bombers in the world and was more damaging than the destruction of the military and defense equipment at Pearl Harbor. MacArthur was either complicit in a plan to permit massive damage and the eventual relinquishment of the islands, or he was thoroughly incompetent. If he were that incompetent, he would have been reprimanded. Instead, he remained commander of the U.S. forces, got a promotion and a Congressional Medal of Honor. Is that something or what? Okay, so getting back to what happened when the Japanese came on board at Manila, which they did on January 2nd, 1942, the Japanese entered Manila. And Major General Wainwright's men, with their old and defective World War I Enfield rifles, were unable to prevent Japan's invading General Masaharu from advancing to Manila. Apparently, they had no... How do you like that? Old weapons, it was like shooting fish in a barrel, okay? Apparently, they had no choice but to flee. Filipino and American forces outnumbered the Japanese invaders by 3-2, but numerical superiority was insufficient because they were so poorly trained and equipped. Remember, MacArthur was supposed to train him. He was too busy at the country club. The United States had planned to increase armaments, but they only met 20% of their artillery requirements, so they were insufficiently equipped. To save Manila from utter destruction, leaders declared it an open city. Wainwright and his men, according to Plan Orange, withdrew from Manila to Bataan, where there would ultimately be over 100,000 refugees. Unfortunately, MacArthur had failed to make adequate logistical preparations in Bataan, as the military left most of the food and other supplies on the beaches and were consequently lost, possibly to opportunists who would soon make a fortune in the black market. On Bataan, the starving, embattled 26th Cavalry eventually had to shoot and eat their horses. The Filipinos took advantage of the chaos in Manila and were killing each other, settling old scores, and eliminating enemies. Rape, robbery, and looting were widespread. Ferdinand Marcos, on the American side, took this opportunity to eliminate the man who had testified against him when Marcos murdered his stepfather's political opponent. His biological father, Judge Ferdinand Chua, then exonerated him and escaped incarceration. Chua, who people considered Marcos' godfather, also paid his way through law school. The economy of Luzon, the largest island, was a disaster. People were starving as thugs had seized the crops. Gangs roamed the streets. Currency was worthless, and people paid gemstones or gold for whatever food they could find on the black market, a devious way of acquiring valuables from desperate people. So all you people who are buying gold, you better hide it. Residents abandoned homes, factories, and warehouses. General MacArthur regularly relied on staff officers and stayed as far away from the enemy as possible. On January 9, 1942, he left Corregidor on a PT boat and made his first and only visit back to the peninsula. American troop reinforcements and supplies, as per Plan Orange, were on their way across the Pacific, but quite curiously, Roosevelt recalled them. Reportedly, the United States government needed the food and men more urgently in Europe than in the Philippines. Was it poor planning, poor judgment, or deliberate defeat? I would say it's deliberate defeat. This was a death knell for troops who had been fighting for 9 long weeks. On January 17, 1942, the Japanese-sponsored Manila Tribune announced, and I quote, "Tojo promises freedom in 1943. On February 2nd, from Corregidor, the voice of freedom reminded the Filipinos that they could not trust the Japanese. Well, of course, we know that they couldn't trust the Americans, too. That seemed incredibly hypocritical, considering the U.S. government had just recalled promised supplies and reinforcements. On February 4, 1942, the submarine Trout arrived at Corregidor to transfer the Philippine Treasury's gold. I don't think they ever got it back either, folks. Many Filipinos, especially the privileged class like Jose P. Laurel, the occupation puppet president from 1943 to 1945, chose to collaborate with the Japanese in order to survive. They felt that the U.S. Army forces far east had abandoned them to a cruel and bitter fate. Gosh, I wonder why they thought that. On February 20th, 1942, Quezon, ill from tunnel life, and Osmeña, and other members of the presidential party left Corregidor for Mindanao, where they stayed until March 11, 1942, when MacArthur abandoned the disease-ridden, starving troops, army nurses, American civilians, and many others who could testify about his abject incompetence. The entire group left the Philippines for Australia sometime in April. Public relations releases from Corregidor salvaged MacArthur's reputation and portrayed him as a war hero. Quezon then went to America, never to return to the Philippines. Vice President Osmeña became president in exile. For ballast, MacArthur had his men load 20 tons of gold into the U.S. submarine that would soon be leaving for Australia, where Roosevelt promoted him to Supreme Allied Commander of the Southwest Pacific Area. MacArthur left behind him a huge military fiasco, vowing to return. He abandoned 20,000 exhausted soldiers who remained in the Philippines and subsisted on a third of a ration per day. Wainwright stayed with the troops and took control on March 23, 1942. Bataan fell on April 9, 1942. Corregidor fell on May 6. As many as 8,000 Filipino and 2,000 Americans perished from malaria, starvation, beatings, and executions during the infamous Bataan Death March to Camp O'Donnell. This is just the worst. On April 9, 1942, about 66,000 Filipino and 12,000 U.S. troops surrendered to the Japanese in Bataan, the largest numerical reversal ever suffered by an American force in a single engagement with a foreign foe. The Japanese intended to force march the prisoners from Bataan to San Fernando, about 60 miles. From San Fernando, the Japanese transported the prisoners by train to concentration camps in central Luzon. The troops had been fighting, and many were sick, undernourished, and wounded. The Japanese guards were hostile, cruel, and made no concessions for the debilitated condition of their captives. They made no provisions for the sick and provided only meager amounts of food and water. The men were organized into groups of 100, situated in four columns, and forced marched for miles. The majority of them were suffering from malaria, severe diarrhea, or dysentery, symptoms of their recent starvation and lack of sanitation. The men were not allowed to leave their assigned column to relieve themselves at the side of the road. One survivor recounted, and I quote, "You would just release wherever you were, on yourself or somebody else. Without food, it was water more than anything," unquote. The guards beat the men in the head with their rifle butts to keep the long lines of sick and struggling men moving. Those who could not keep up were lassoed with a long black snake whip and dragged to death behind a truck. According to survivors, Korean guards were even more barbaric than the Japanese soldiers. The Japanese hated both the Koreans and Americans, not because of ethnicity, but because they surrendered instead of choosing self-inflicted death. Therefore, they had absolutely no mercy on the Americans, even the sick and wounded. They were beaten with thick, stinging stalks of sugarcane for the most minor infraction. The men were not allowed any water during their march in the hot sun. If they broke out of line in an attempt to drink water from any marshes along the way, the guards shot them. The prisoners received insufficient amounts of water at night before the guards enclosed them in overcrowded barbed wire cages. There were no toilet facilities, and the men had to sit in filth and the feces of those who inhabited the indescribably stinking putrid enclosures the night before. At San Fernando, 100 men were jammed into each boxcar, where there was standing room only. When the guards closed the doors, it was like an oven. One survivor wrote, and I quote, "Men fainted with no place to fall. As the car swayed, the urine, the sweat, and the vomit rolled 3 inches deep back and forth, around and in our shoes," unquote. The trains were destined for Camp O'Donnell, a former U.S. Army base. Japan had not signed the Geneva Conventions regarding the treatment of POWs. Therefore, Red Cross provisions never reached the camp. Not that signing or not signing made any difference to any country who imprisoned their enemies. The Japanese camp guards ignored the prisoners who were regularly dying from malaria, dysentery, diphtheria, and dry beriberi. Bodies piled up because graves couldn't... This is difficult, and you know how I am. Bodies piled up because graves could not be dug quickly enough to accommodate the numbers of the dead. Holes could not be deeper than 4 feet because of the high water table. Instead, many corpses were fated for watery graves. A U.S. soldier on a burial detail said, and I quote, "While we shoveled dirt on them, we had to hold them down with poles. Otherwise, they'd float. At night, the dogs went wild. They'd dig up the graves to get at the bodies," unquote. The Japanese captured 132,134 Anglo-American prisoners during World War II. We'll be right back. And we are back. This is Deanna. As I said before the break, the Japanese captured 132,134 Anglo-American prisoners during World War II. Of that number, 35,756, or 27%, died in captivity. Now, we don't hear a lot about this, and if you read the accurate history, then you come to understand that MacArthur is a very questionable man when you read about some of the other stuff that he has pulled. And, of course, we don't hear about this in the mainstream press or in the so-called, the official version of history. Now, Douglas MacArthur was the son of Arthur MacArthur. And Arthur MacArthur had been in the Philippines much earlier. In fact, he was there when the United States first invaded the Philippines. And the United States controlled the Philippines from the time they invaded it up until 1935-36 and even after that. And MacArthur originally, well, the younger MacArthur, Douglas, was in the Philippines in 1904, and he spent several months in San Francisco. And then he accompanied his father, the commander of the Army's Pacific Division, on an extensive inspection tour of Asia after the Russo-Japanese War. And during the next 16 years, he had worked in Washington under Chief of Staff Leonard Wood. Now, it's very interesting that that the older General MacArthur would travel all throughout Asia. I think they were just on a fact-finding mission to see what kind of military operations they had, and also to assess assets. And in the fall of 1934, President Quezon visited Douglas MacArthur in the U.S. to see if he would come back and supervise the Philippine Army because of the Japanese aggression. And so Douglas MacArthur went to the Philippines in October 1935, and he became very active in Freemasonry in the islands. And MacArthur was very flamboyant. He decided that he would design his own uniform, which included black pants, a white tunic, a braided cap, a gold baton, and all these medals and stars and gold cord to impress the most impressionable person. And Quezon built MacArthur a luxurious penthouse with a spectacular view of Manila Bay atop the newly renovated Manila Hotel. Now, with all of these activities, no wonder he didn't have time to actually train anybody. And he became the director for the posh Manila Hotel and received generous shares of Benque mining stock. Now, Benque was a gold mining company. Meanwhile, people accused him of neglecting his military responsibilities, including maintaining 22,000 U.S. and 8,000 Filipino soldiers. Well, I guess that's what he did, but he sure had a good time. And, at the country club and at the hotel and, with his Freemason friends. What can I say? Have a great weekend, folks, and thanks for listening today.